Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009. Good evening and welcome to Allowed at Central Library. Pleasure to see you here tonight. I'm Louise Steinman, the curator of the Allowed series, and it's a great pleasure to welcome you here tonight for the world premiere of Visions in the Desert, Searching for Home in the West. Before we start, a few things. If you turn off your cell phones and pagers, which would be great. As many of you know, the Allowed series is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which makes these free events possible. We love to present adventurous work like this. This is a place where it can happen. If you enjoy programs like this or have been coming to this, we really appreciate your support if you're a library associate and support the Library Foundation. And there are many, many activities in the city. We thank you from the bottom of our hearts. If you would like to help, there's a donation jar out in the lobby, and it really does help if you can pitch in. So thank you very much for considering that. Again, it's a great pleasure tonight. Many of you know Ruben Martinez from his many books, from his work at KCET on Life and Times, but he's also a musician and songwriter and poet. And tonight we have an evening of stories and songs by Ruben Martinez, Visions in the Desert, Searching for a Home in the West, with Joe Garcia and featuring John Scher and Ruben Gonzalez. So please welcome Ruben to start. Thanks.
Hello. My name is Johnny Cash. No, miento. Mi nombre es Cornelio Reina. Not too many Cornelio Reina fans here, apparently, tonight. Welcome to Visions in the Desert. It's a story about how I got there in 1997. I didn't expect to wind up out in the Mojave, but I did. So, one, how you get there. It snowed in the desert. Snow suffused the sand. Icicles hung from yucca spikes. It was late 1997, the beginning of an El Nino winter. I'd come running from Mexico City and arrived in the Mojave because it was close to Los Angeles, my hometown, and because that's where people from L.A., in trouble with the law, their lovers, their creditors, themselves, go hide out, lick their wounds, end the affair, bury the body. I went because my close friend Elia Arce was already there. She, along with a small crew of L.A. expatriates, optimistic bohos, was creating a life for herself in the desert. I was simply trying to save mine. I was on deadline for a book in November of 1997. I had completed the research, as writers like to say to editors when the deadline passes. I called Elia from Mexico City and gave her the lurid details. Rubén, she said, vente para acá. I went para allá. I had just enough in the bank to put down first and last on a house in 29 Palms, about 14 miles east of the village of Joshua Tree, and on the edge of the largest Marine Corps training facility in the U.S. sand dunes that served as a simulacrum of the Iraqi desert for the first Persian Gulf War and would again for the second Persian Gulf War. The rent was $275 a month. I had talked the rental agency down from $400. There weren't many takers at that time for shacks in the sand. A small and nondescript stucco A-frame with thin walls and a composition shingle roof, pale yellow with white trim. There were names etched in the cement of the patio and a year, 1952. There was a fenced yard in the back, a big garage empty except for a truck engine block, a couple of tamarisk trees that whooshed in the wind. The house was on the last paved road in town. There was a sign nearby that read, "Next services, 100 miles. I'd been to Joshua Tree before. It's the duty of every Los Angeles native to make the pilgrimage to see the expressionist boulders, the mise-en-scène for U2's eponymous album. It was on one of my early trips to the desert that I started wearing a cowboy hat. Given my background, you could have assumed that I wore it in emulation of vaquero culture, since a lot of Mexicans in California around that time wore a tejana and danced the quebradita. But I was wearing it to declare myself the cowboy, a man of the West, feet wrapped in snake skin, guitar slung over my shoulder. If Charlie Pride could sing at the Grand Ole Opry, surely there was room for a brown cowboy. Not too many Charlie Pride fans here, apparently, either. Well, a few of you. Thank you. For years, I conducted a tortured love affair with the West. But that relationship was largely conducted in the realm of the imagination. Moving to the house in 29 Palms marked the beginning of a 10-year period where I lived mostly in the West, even as I continued to imagine it. From 29 Palms to Joshua Tree to the village of Velarde in northern New Mexico, with sojourns to southern Arizona and West Texas. During that time, I also married into a Western family, the Garcia clan of Albuquerque, New Mexico. Some of them are here tonight. Despite their wildly contrasting landscapes and human geographies, all these sites shared a few key experiences. All had bona fide Western tourist destinations in them or nearby. Joshua Tree National Park, D.H. Lawrence's cabin, the Rio Grande where it takes its big bend, the landscapes that George O'Keefe and Ansel Adams framed, the oldest continuously inhabited house in America, the Pueblo where you see the turtle dance on New Year's Day, the land set aside to preserve the iconic saguaro cactus. Each of these places was also, to a degree, swept up in the biggest economic boom in American history, the main effect of which was a rapid transformation of the built environment and people moving or being moved. Part of the movement was the increasing numbers of Mexicans and Central Americans arriving in the West. Not in L.A. West, that's west of the West. I'm talking about in the West. Las Vegas, Phoenix, Albuquerque. Building and renovating the boom houses. Washing dishes in the Nouvelle Cuisine eateries. Sweeping casino floors. Folding towels in the luxury hotels. Immigration was a political issue. A cultural one. And a personal one. Finally, to varying degrees, there was a drug problem in each of these places, and I don't mean that generically. The problems were acute and specific to place. The U.S.-Mexico borderland is a region of smuggling and abuse related to it. Some of its peoples endure a profound sense of loss, of land, of status, of history, and may be more vulnerable to drugs because of it. And alcohol, need I say. This was of particular interest to me because I arrived in these places with my own drug problem. It seemed to me that, in one way or another, all the disparate actors on this stage were addicts, whether to heroin, like in Velarde, or, like in the uber art colony of Marfa, Texas, to the baubles of the boom. In Joshua Tree, there was a peculiar and all-consuming lust for the landscape. In Arizona, the nativists were utterly obsessed with their dark other out in the desert, and the Mexicans could see no further than their single-minded drive to get to el otro lado. Each of these intense desires had the tendency to wipe out its neighbors. but I lived in and among them all. The only way to tell my story was to tell theirs. I had never before imagined or seen snow in the desert, but that's how the desert greeted me. A frigid wind blew, a cloud arced, and thick flakes fell to efface the land I thought I knew. 2. The Border Road. 2003. The war without end has begun. During these dark days, most everything is read through the lens of 9/11, including, especially, the border. It is no longer a line that separates America from Mexico, but America from the rest of the scary world. We take a road trip from San Diego eastward along the line, thinking we'll go along it as far as we can or want to. It is August, hellish hot, and we start out, things are romantic and fun. We are, Angela and I, after all, of the generation that thought this line would be the next wall to come down. We dance back and forth across it, cosmic cowboy and cowgirl, undoing fences on the range. We wear the hats. Angela, one of those cheap, soft straw ones with a lot of little holes that art girls love. I buy one of hard straw, pale yellow, with a nice soft leather band inside, the kind of hat an elder Mexicano would wear, not to work, but for his Sunday best. In Douglas, Arizona, we ride along Geronimo Trail, which shadows the border a good ways to the New Mexico state line. The dirt road rises from the furnace of the desert floor several thousand feet into the temperate forest of the Coronado National Monument. For an hour, we don't pass a single vehicle, not even Border Patrol. But suddenly, a white car is coming at us, fast, issuing a tail of yellow dust. It looks like an old four-door Chevy, maybe a 1970s Impala. I slow down, but the other driver doesn't until he absolutely has to. As we meet, everyone checks everyone else out. They're Mexicans. The driver throws a hard look. He looks to be in his 30s, wearing aviator shades and a mustache, a stock character, like Azul from El Mariachi. Now, I'm thinking to myself, don't stare too long, Rubén. Keep your own look really hard now, too. And turn away like you don't give a shit, like you're on a mission, too, like you belong on this land. As soon as we're clear of each other, my eyes dart to the rearview mirror. He speeds up again. I say something to Angela like, wonder what they're up to. Eyes back to the rearview mirror. A big eruption of dust, like from the impact of a mortar round, swallows the Impala. It reappears in a second, spinning its tires in a sudden U-turn, and now headed back towards us, fast. You wanted your fix of Borderlands drama, Rubén? Well, here it is. Why are they coming after us? Smugglers, of course, who see in my Silverado a less suspicious ride to get their cargo across. Yeah, that's it. They'll push us off the road, steal the truck, and leave us stranded. That's the vanilla version. That's the best scenario I can imagine. The worst, of course, is the narco-satanic version. We know what that looks like from B-movies on both sides of the border, and even a cult indie parody, Perdida Durango, starring Javier Bardem and Rosie Perez, playing a couple who get their kicks from torturing wholesome white kids. But mostly, we visualize the narrative with the help of Cormac McCarthy and the Coen brothers. Those aren't humans in that car. That's evil incarnate. An implacable scream of darkness sweeping across the land and swallowing everything on it. The four horsemen of the apocalypse have traded their mounts in for a 1970s Impala. And of course, the front man of the crew must be, like in No Country for Old Men and Perdida Durango, Javier Bardem. Perfectly swarthy for the role and with a faint Latin accent to boot. The possibility that the actual passengers in the Impala are lost or in need of help never crosses my mind. I speed up, but you can only go so fast on this road. The Mexicans follow us, but not too closely, which only increases the tension. They're playing mind games, the fuckers. We make the summit of the pass. where there is a plaque commemorating the Coronado expedition's passage through here 463 years ago. The illegal aliens of their day, lusting after the riches they believed the land held for them. Now I remember there's a ranger station a few miles down the other side of the mountain. The Chevy follows us all the way, never breaking its discreet distance. We pull into the parking lot, and the white car just keeps going. The driver doesn't look in our direction as he passes. 3, in the shadow of the Black Mesa. Angela and I both come from families of addiction. Angela wants to write her dissertation on the theme. The subject is too close to home to write it there, so she chooses a village 100 miles north of Albuquerque. It is called Velarde, where we make our first home together. Get the fuck out of here! Sunday afternoon. For the past hour, screams and crying, fists on a car hood, screen door slammed a dozen times, and in the midst of it all, the voice of a small boy talking to himself in a make-believe game. I edge up to the window in the attic that gives a direct view of their adobe. I said I want you out of here! Get the fuck out of my life! That's her most oft-repeated line. She struts back inside again, door slams. Now it's quiet in the courtyard and in the rest of the village. These are my neighbors, Rose Garcia and Jose Martinez. They're a young couple, both 23 years old. Their boy is about 5. She is light-skinned, a coyota, as they say in New Mexico, with long, thick black hair that she teases up in front. She's always wearing a t-shirt, pants, and flip-flops. What's most striking about her body is its constant tension, every pose taut and blunt as a hammer. Jose Martinez is a short, spidery dude. He wears his baseball caps backwards, triple X size white t-shirts, and, during the summer, shorts and tennis shoes. What little hair peeks out from beneath the cap is cut very close. You have to strain to hear his responses to Rose's screams. It sounds like he's talking through a towel. Look at you, you're psycho, eh? That's Jose. Go to that puta of yours! That's Rose. She coughs a lot. I hear it early in the morning, late at night. I hear it very clearly when she is sitting on the patio smoking a J. It is quick and sharp, the throat clenching and the tissue grating deep inside her chest. Traffic's been heavy lately. About a dozen cars a day drive through. They are men, all Hispanos, young and old, mostly in work trucks. Some will come early in the morning on their way to their jobs. Others in the early evening on their way home. Some in the middle of the day. Some in the wee hours. It is Rose's house. The Garcias are an old and connected family. One Garcia owns the nightclub in the village. Another the fruit stand that never seems to be open out on the highway. So well connected that our landlady gave us the advice she was given by the cops when she reported that Jose had stolen her lawnmower. We can't touch them, the cops said. But if you want to take care of business, shoot them, drag them into your house, and make it look like self-defense. Get the fuck out of here, you fuck! You and your pills, and you think I'm fucked up? Look in the mirror. Right. She does the pills. He does the heroin. Or the methadone. So I watch and listen through the screen of the attic window. We've exchanged only a handful of words with our neighbors, which, given the circumstances, seems the sensible thing to do. After all, this is where we live. Did we want Rose banging on our door, hysterical after a fight? But not opening our doors to them seemed to me to also be a moral issue. Weren't our ideals of solidarity and hospitality, which imbued the articles and books that we wrote, about situations precisely like these? There was no way to look out the window at Rose and Jose without recognizing their profound sadness and pain. Over a period of months adjusting to life in Velarde, we come to an agreement, all of us. We won't get in their shit, and they won't get in ours. But still, I go to the window in the attic. When I talk with my other neighbor, Joe, Rendon. Across the fence, sometimes the subject of Rose and Jose comes up. He shakes his head. Joe's young, but he talks like he's old, a man of tradition. He's always reminding me that the Rendones go back here to since forever. Back in the day, we owned the land all the way from the highway to the river. Apple orchards and pasture, cows and sheep. And there was good snow every winter and good rain every summer. The acequias ran full, he says. Oh yeah, there were fights, of course, and a lot of drinking, sure. But not cocaine and heroin. No way. But now look at us. The sun dips below the black mesa, bringing Velarde's early twilight. Rose explodes one last time. I can't take it anymore. She jumps in her red Chevy SUV and charges up the road in a cloud of dust. Jose stays behind with their son, who is still playing with his imaginary friend over by the gate with the big caution, children at play sign. She returns in a few minutes. She screams some more and goes back inside the house. At true dusk, when the last of the sunlight bleeds away from the eastern hills beyond the reach of the mesa's shadow and leaves them in a blue-gray pallor, I hear her once again. I can see the dome light on in Jose's black sedan with the tinted windows. He's sitting inside it in the driveway, listening to music that I can't hear. I eat dinner alone. Angela is on the graveyard shift at the clinic when the addicts experience the worst of the withdrawal. I look out the attic window one last time before I go to bed. The dome light is off from the sedan. A thin line of light seeps through the crack at the bottom of the front door. 4. Lonesome Land. This is about my mother-in-law, who is in the audience tonight. She hasn't heard this before. When Angela first brought me home to visit her mother, Wilma, she was married to Clark, a man about 20 years younger than her. This was long before Oprah hosted cougar-themed shows. But Wilma had always shown an iconoclastic streak in choosing her partners. There was much of the Western at Wilma's house. This is in Albuquerque. She was on the edge of the big empty that fills our imaginations, of course, and the monsoon storms raked the sky, leaving it startlingly naked. Lawyers and developers and land grant heirs fought over the land and water. Great high-tension towers stood watch over the Sage Plain, the last great undeveloped swath in the metro area, and thus potentially worth hundreds of millions of dollars. There were Indian pueblos on the horizon, their casinos glaring in the night. And there was Wilma herself, granddaughter of a woman who was born on the Apache Reservation, daughter of mining people from the Silver City area. She went to school at a time when you were severely punished for pronouncing Spanish vowels, years before anyone called themselves Chicano or took public pride in speaking Spanish or Spanglish. And the threat of the bomb, which had been built up north in Los Alamos and tested down south in Alamogordo, hung over it all. So, of course, she took off with the bushy-haired Greek-American academic who would become her first husband when he offered. There were stops in Maine and Idaho, among others. And, of course, she came back to New Mexico when she left him. The West was home to her people, after all. And here she put together the philosophy to defend herself against the world that willed against Mexicans and Indians and women and people who lived in trailers. She read a lot. She took extension courses. She watched public television. She picked up a bit from Carlos Castañeda and from Gloria Steinem and from Sandra Cisneros and from Ana Castillo and A Course in Miracles. And she loved the Da Vinci Code and went to a church that Angela, her daughter, thought smacked of Scientology, but Wilma insisted, no, it didn't. And what if it did? A few months into the separation from Clark, she got a job at a print shop near the airport, collating, stapling, part-time, no benefits. She loved it. These two were her people. She started hanging out with one of the pressmen. He had long hair and a beard and freckles and liked bandanas. Keith looked like Willie Nelson and talked about the article he just read in The Nation and working on strike crews in the burning hills of San Diego County when he was a kid and about the Ferrari he was fixing up at home. Of course he was married, but soon enough, he wasn't. And Keith and Wilma looked to be set. Then she hesitated. Other men appeared. Older guys, Hispanos. There was Paul, handsome and bronzed. He'd been to Europe and had all the know-how to finish up converting the trailer or knock it down to start anew. There was John, a Harley-riding retired federal agent who carried himself more like an outlaw. Ate only one meal a day, drank the rest of it, but he never dropped his bike. All of them were middle-aged, and all of them were respectable and respectful of her. They'd all worked their whole lives hard, were strong and calm on the outside, and inside, it seems to me, they were pretty beat up. There were Saturday afternoons at Wilma's when she'd invite all her suitors, and they'd all actually show up and pretend to get along with one another, and each would make sure to get a few minutes with Wilma one-on-one in a quiet corner, Wilma's version of The Bachelorette. Her children and in-laws all had opinions about who she should choose. That is, we all thought that she should choose one and thought we knew which one was best for her. So one night we took her out to dinner. This was a terrible idea. One night we took her out to dinner and told her it was time to make a decision. That we didn't like this one and that one, and told her which one we did. She looked down into her drink for a long moment. Then she looked up and told us all to F off. She stalked out of the restaurant that she thought was pretentious. It was on Knob Hill, a gentrified strip of Central Avenue, also known as Snob Hill, and drove herself home. Everyone jumped in their cars, and we caught up with her at her place, where she said that all she wanted was for us to leave her alone, that she liked things just the way they were. Didn't we realize that she'd given over a quarter of a century of her life to those marriages, and now she felt good alone? Now she wanted friends. She wanted friends who wanted to be friends with her. And there were times, more and more lately, when she felt so good to come home from her job to the empty house, to the TV with the rabbit ears, and to pour herself a gin and tonic and light up a Camel and watch McNeil. Or was it Lehrer? She could never remember which one left. And just be in her body. Just be in her body, in her house, out on the mesa. Five, Tomasa. Al's swinger was housed in a teetering stucco a couple of blocks off of Highway 62 in 29 Palms. Its founder, Al Artisan, was recognized as the first black business owner in the high desert, and Al's was the only black bar in the Morongo Basin. There is no black bar in the Morongo Basin now. By the time I arrived, Al was in failing health and had delegated running the bar to Tomasa Castro, a.k.a. Tammy, a mulata from Panama that had married into the Marines, lived on the base for many years, divorced, and come to Al looking for work. She was in her 50s, short and pear-shaped, with big, deep brown eyes that perfectly matched the tan of her skin. She wore long artificial nails and wrapped her hair in scarves. She had a booming voice and spoke a patois of English in its black American dialect and Spanish in its Central American dialect. She sang off-key and with great gusto, sometimes to karaoke, sometimes spontaneously an a cappella. Among her favorites was the Mexican bolero standard, Tú Solo Tú, by the Selena version, of course. And she always teared up at Satchmo's What a Wonderful World. She ruled the bar with absolute authority, aided by her equalizer, an axe handle with black electrical tape for a grip on one end. She drank alongside her customers, but she never got sloppy. I'm writing about 1997, 1998, when I first got to the desert. Flash forward. In the mid-2000s, boom. That ragamuffin boho crew that I'd arrived in the desert with had actually played the role of pioneers for the wave that followed. The art dealers, the speculators, the journalists, the Mexicans who hammered at wood frames in the sun. And as in any season of gentrification, the place changed fast. Buildings went up, were torn down, were rehabbed, were cleverly appointed. People moved, and they were moved. The Los Angeles Times came saw and proclaimed desert cool. And then the New York Times came, visited with the artist formerly of New York named Andrea Zittel, who said it was so great to live in the middle of nowhere, which is the same thing as saying that no one lived there before Zittel, that is. Tammy lived there. Tammy lived. And a place called Al Swinger existed. It was a watering hole for the margins of the margins, working class of color, Marines, a haven for a lost writer like me. Tammy was at the center of it all, and she relished the role she played, the only public power she'd ever known, that of the bartender who was gatekeeper and keeper of the peace and the conductor of the jukebox and the karaoke mic. After Al died, Tammy did not have the money to buy out his heirs, and she did not know or had too much pride to ask anyone who did. The bar closed less than a year after Al's death. There was a for sale sign on the inside of the front window for almost 6 years. The boom tornado swirled through town, but avoided Al's. It was a teardown, after all. The signage remained, though. Al's Swinger, in chipped red on the facade, and Al's Catfish Dinners on the sidewall. It finally sold in 2007. Around that time, I stopped by the Virginian, another Marine bar in town run by Alice, a Southeast Asian matron who resembled Tammy in many ways with her big voice and body and heart. Alice said that she'd heard that the building would become an art gallery. "We don't need another art gallery," one of the drunken patrons drunkenly boomed. "We need another bar." The new owners immediately whitewashed Al's old signs. I fully expected to see a gallery rise up. But the speculators, they were speculating, after all, that the boom in Joshua Tree would migrate to 29 Palms, as had the people who tried and failed to establish a boulangerie a few years back. But of course, the boom was not the end of Western history, just one point on the circle, on the other side of which was the bust. Whoever bought Al's did so just as mortgage karma was beginning to topple the house of cards that the boom had been all along. I drove by just the other day. The original building is still there. I saw a white sheet of paper taped on the inside of the front window where the for sale sign had been. It was a notice of foreclosure. The would-be gallery owners didn't do a very good job of painting over the old signs. You could still read Al Swinger very clearly on the facade, the old red paint emerging from the whitewash. Coda, snow in the desert. On one of my first frigid nights in that thin-walled house on the edge of the 100-mile nothing, I heard what I thought was the hiss of a gas leak. A thorough inspection turned up nothing. It wasn't a rattlesnake or even the wind through the tamarisks. It took me a long while to realize I'd never been in a place of such perfect silence. I realized that I was listening to the blood coursing through my own body. I went to the local animal shelter and rescued an Akita named Bear, abandoned by a Marine suddenly transferred overseas. Bear walked me in the desert every day. In my shack on the sand, I watched Boogie Nights and Train Spotting. I couldn't write, but I was surrounded by scruffy boho cowboys who strummed guitars around campfires, the crowd my friend Elia had hooked up with. I had my grandfather's guitar with me. He was a cowboy. I mean, a ranchero. In the big silence, I began to hear melodies, to which I set the stories that would become a book. Settle in. Oh, where's John Cher? Are y'all in tune? That's a good G. You got a G there? Sounds good to me. Reuben G, you get the honors.
edge of the valley, where the mesas rise. There's a sandy cemetery with no names you'd recognize, and just a few blocks away she stares out the window. Trailer to the city, creeping up from below. There was a time, she said, when the land was just like bread. Made what it gave, then it was your grave. The city beats the sand, and no one takes a stand. The dust. In the lonesome land, in the lonesome land, now the neighbors, they are new, as the box they call them home. They came here for the view of the faces in the stone. And as they ride in from work, and the shadows fill the air, their voices in the dark are like fish. Hard enough, and the romance, it gets rough. Real estate ain't real if the loan company steals. Backs against the wall, they watch the beer to fall. Rain dies in air so dry, the promise was a lie. In the lonesome land, in the lonesome land, there's a corral that was empty for years. Now families moved in, speaking a language she fears. Not a word across the fence for weeks at a time. Now and then she throws a glance at the horse across the line. Now we all look out at each other's doubts across a wrinkled earth that's dying of thirst. And the dead tell us they dreamed just like us, and like us they fell. We'll have to sail and leave the lonesome land. Leave the lonesome land. Leave the lonesome land.
like to call Joe Garcia the one-man band. As you can see, he has more instruments over there than all of us other here combined. And so he's switching guitars, and I'm talking to you right now to kind of pass the time. Only how you doing, Joe?
Good.
Joe Garcia on
only
guitar.
Only one at a time. Thank you. Thank you, Ruben.
Mr. John Shayer on bass. And Ruben Gonzalez on drums. Thank you for your warm welcome.
Celaje rojizo, trae un pensamiento de un sueño hechizo que alguna vez fue la verdad. En el pueblo donde vivía, el agua cantaba, los momentos flotaban sobre una laguna perfumada. En sus muslos cristalinos fue un amor que no merecía con sus besos asesinos. Llegó una tormenta de agua truculenta, llovían dardos de papel escurriendo tinta negra. Caliente, junto a una mar verde, desolado el paisaje, sin señal alguna de gente. No hay sendero de retorno, ni manera de marcar tiempo. Muy lejos de Belén, estoy al este del Edén.
Sunrise. It's about Velarde. About to set in the west, the sun's about to rise in the east. I don't know in which direction lies my peace. To shoot sun or moon is best. My snaky, tweaking body's aching for rest. My rattled, pottled soul is vulture's feast. My broken window late, the twilight. My love dressed in a dusty disguise. My New Mexico sunrise. Now my landscape is a sieve of fear. A fiery ladder to the stars. Everything near and dear is now so far. From the child that Pop took to shop at Sears. And in this sail with chilly razor blade bars, dreams of yucca tears. My broken window lady of the twilight. My lover dressed in a dusty disguise brings my New Mexico sun. Mexico sun. Traffic starts to howl down on the 10.
bombing begins the war without end. As the blurry world spins into ether deep. And now I lay my body down to sleep. And tell myself I won't do it.
Titles like an opera, you know, or a program. Next time we'll have the program so we can be fully bilingual, all of us. This one's in Spanish and it's for Tammy. It's called Tomasa. Oh, wait, sorry. Almost?
Yeah, good save.
That would have sounded terrible.
Remember the.
Okay. Tomasa. De Panamá, los caminos la llevaron hasta Wichita. Llegó sola, ahí gozó su primer amor, también sufrió su primer dolor. Sin saber el rumbo, va a salvarse de ese tiempo. Dice Tomasa, Tomasa, busca casa sola en un pueblo. Una noche se pelearon y la golpeó por primera vez. Cogió camión sin saber el rumbo para salvarse de ese. Regresar a su tierra
nostalgia acompañada. Sin poder buscarse a sí misma. Mira la niña quebrada de la carretera.
Joe Garcia happens to be a native. Of Española. That's right. All right. Here we go.
Yep.
Your roots go deep on the land beneath your feet. Got your hand down that sky, and on this land you're gonna die. It's a beauty that kills when the needle fills and time stands still. With the memory of water rushing free. In the shadow of the old black mesa, in la sombra de la mesa prieta, Rose stands down the river, screams to be delivered, and I'm a world. Right to get paid. Rose in her prison with her cactus warden and her arms all swollen. Between me sombra de la mesa aprieta. In the shadow of the old black mesa. En la sombra de la mesa aprieta. Consoles on the road. His daddy's out there too. Joe Wilson. Out of town where the dead make the sound of the wind coming round. And the old move on and the young pass on. Even Joe. De la mesa aprieta. In the shadow of the old black mesa. En la sombra de la mesa aprieta.
Himself manipulating all the levers and making it sound nice. Russell Pyle, sound engineer. Thanks to my bandmates and to you for coming. This song is called Me Muero. Do I need to translate that? I'm dying. Me muero de ganas. Mi amor.
Okay. Settle down.
Yo vivo estoy. Si yo vivo para verte, yo vivo. Medio muerto estoy, si contigo no me voy. Yo vivo, mi amor, medio muerto. Entre la vida y la muerte, entre el amar y tu vientre, entre la montaña y mi mente, Dios es la distancia entre nos.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.